Well, thanks again for the invitation. We have heard this morning some interesting discussions and lectures about the alpha model or the averaged model and connections somehow with the Kamasa-Holm. This is a classical transparency, therefore I would like to be, in some sense, use it. And I'm going to talk about the connection of Kamasa-Holm equations, because that's how I knew the equation. And I'm going to tell a little bit about the history, about how I know the equations and how they came about. The first part of my talk is about existence, uniqueness, and attractors, which is joint work with Ciprian Foyash and Daryl Holm. And the second part is about turbulence channel flows when we apply these equations into physical problem in simple geometry. And this is joint work with Xie Chin, Ciprian Foyash, Daryl Holm, and at the time, Eric Olson and Shannon Wen were students, but now both of them are colleagues and PhDs. So, and this work was done basically when we were in Los Alamos for 1 year, Ciprian and myself. All right, so for this audience, here's the Navier-Stokes equation, incompressible. I'm not going to basically talk about the boundary conditions at the moment, because this is a very touchy and sticky issue. And these are the viscous Kamasa-Holm equations, or basically the averaged equations. And let me tell you where these equations are coming from. Let's look to the viscosity and forget about it. If you look for the one-dimensional case, namely you forget about the divergence free conditions, this is an equation which is a shallow water model, which has been derived and used by Roberto Kamasa and Daryl Holm. And then actually the same equation seems to be happened to exist in literature by others before or at the same time in different contexts. Whether they were derived rigorously or not, I don't really follow the literature. But nonetheless, the one-dimensional equations has been used as a shallow water model by Kamasa and by Holm. And one summer I was in Los Alamos, and as usual, whenever I go there, they're all coming, you know, energetic, says, oh, look what's the new things we have. And basically introduced to me this set of equations, which he says, without the viscosity, he said, oh, this is the mathematical generalization of the 1D Kamasa-Holm equation. Namely, if you look to the Hamiltonian and you look for the LH1 norm instead of like the L2 norm in the Hamiltonian, and you derive them through the Euler-Poincaré variational principle, you get this system of interesting mathematical equations. Well, at that time, what was with us also, Marcel Oliver, was postdoc with me in Irvine, and said, okay, we work on the 2D case because they are like Euler equation, but they are nicer than Euler equation. And in that case, we basically proposed to Marcel and Chinar to work on the 2D Euler equation, the 2D version of this equation without the viscosity, because we were hoping for better uniqueness result. The best known uniqueness result for 2D Euler is in the vorticity near infinity. And because this equation has a nicer behavior, we were hoping for better. And that's basically project was given for. But then, I mean, when I look at these equations, well, yeah, but the other one are much, much better. So, and in fact, Steve Scholar and Marcel just recently has published paper related to that project proposed to Marcel by Daryl myself a few years ago. In any case, then basically I told Daryl, well, let's put viscosity to this equation and see what happens to these mathematical equations. I'm a PDE guy. So we added the viscosity term. And we added this viscosity term because if I put Laplacian of U, I wouldn't get the global existence results. These mathematical equations, I put a mathematical viscosity and see what's happening. So we put Laplacian of V, and then we managed to get global existence and uniqueness. And then I went on from Los Alamos. Ciprian came there, and Daryl again says, hey, how are you doing? We will be doing this stuff, da-da-da, with Idris. And he says, oh, wait a minute. These are nice equations. First of all, let them make them dimensionally correct. Let's stick alpha square, because before there was no alpha square. And now when we stick the alpha square, this dimensional number came suddenly for these mathematical equations. And then Ciprian got excited and says, let's estimate the dimension of the attractor. And now I'm going to tell you the rest of the story as it comes along. So, here are these mathematical equations, which is, I'm calling them now the Kamasa-Holm. We can change the title later if we want, if we agree on that. These are basically the equations. One can really look at them differently by just a change in nonlinearity. They look at this like this relationship. Or basically, if you are in periodic domain and you assume there's no boundary effect and in that case you can invert this operator, and if you invert it, you look, the equations looks like this. Now, why I wanted to write the equations look like this? Because if you look at the equation of U, it's Laplacian of U, so the viscosity is on U. If you look at the nonlinear term, you have two derivatives in U, three derivatives on U, and two integrations on U, therefore there's one derivative on U. So there is no eddy viscosity, there is no ad hoc viscosity or hyperviscosity in the equation. However, what happens, you have this Laplacian also acting on the first component, which makes it smoother. And this is in some sense, without the viscosity, because it preserves the nice H1 norm, this is in some sense nonlinear dispersion. And that's what makes these equations even much more interesting from a PDE point of view, that it's not a hyperviscosity which makes things work nicely. So let me now go very fast through the question about global existence for Navier-Stokes equation. The Navier-Stokes equation, this is the energy equation, this is the balance of energy, as all of everybody knows it. The nonlinearity disappears, and the pressure disappears. Again, I'm in periodic box just for to simplify issues. This is the energy balance. One uses the so-called Poincaré inequality. I'm assuming the average of the flow spatially is zero. And therefore, by Poincaré inequality, the gradients or the entropy, we also call it entropy. The entropy is bounded from below by the energy. And then once you do that, we also call it H12. So we use both notation. One can get simply that the energy is under control, namely remains finite or bounded. And by the same token, one finds that in average, in time, the entropy remains bounded. So now you would like to look to the entropy and see if it is remains bounded for every moment. Because the divergence free of U, it is equivalent to the curl, the L2 norm of the curl, and the question...
Can I
you can't interrupt, you are the boss, I mean, I have no say on that.
K2 depends on capital T.
K2, well, I divided by T.
Correct, but still depends on capital T, otherwise you get
more. No. Oh, he wants to take T goes to... He wants to get capital T goes to zero, yes. Okay, so... He wants to take derivative here, like. You taught freshman calculus recently, that's why.
Okay.
Well, maybe I have, I didn't tell you. Okay, all right. So basically, this quantity remains under control, depending on T, as has been pointed out here by the master. All right, so looking for the equation of balance for the entropy, this is the equation of balance for the entropy. And again, you don't have any more free time, so this is not zero, you have to handle it. The way mathematicians handle it is by trying to squeeze as much identities as possible, and after you give up, you go brutally with the hammer and estimate it. You give some nonlinear estimates. I'm not going to go through all this stuff, but if you do go through all these nonlinear estimates using Holder inequalities and some interpolation or calculus inequalities, you discover that this quantity, which is 1 plus the entropy, satisfies this kind of nonlinear inequality, y dot less than cy cube. On the other hand, just by the thing which has been pointed out, this average of y is also under control, and the question, can this plus this together show that y remains finite? And the answer is, we don't know. All what we can show that there is a finite time, t star, from this and this together tells you that y remains finite for this time. After that time, the right-hand side could become infinite or could remain finite, we don't know, but we can guarantee short-time finiteness of the entropy momentarily. And this is basically the problem of global existence of strong solutions for Navier-Stokes, is basically lies on this shell. You know, they wanted it in a nutshell. Here is one side of the shell, here is the other side of the shell. Okay, so this is in a nutshell where we are standing as far as 3D Navier-Stokes equation. Ironically, if you look for the 2D using these similar calculus inequalities, you get basically y dot less than cy square plus this average, and this with this together, you can factor this y square into one of them integrating factor, and integrate, you can get what yt remains finite for all time. Okay? And this is basically shows global existence for 2D Navier-Stokes. So this is the other shell. This is the the two nutshells for the 3D, and this is the two nutshells for the 3D. Ironically, 3 for 3D, 2 for 2D. Okay, this is the end of the story as far as Navier-Stokes equation. However, if we look at the vorticity formulation, as we all like to look, especially physicists, the vorticity, basically the evolution for the vorticity for the Navier-Stokes equation is given by this. I insisted on omega being curl of U. On the Kamasa-Holm equation with the viscosity, the way I introduced it, the vorticity behaves according to this equation. Now, what's the difference between this and this? It's basically the nonlinearity, or the vorticity stretching and transport. In the Navier-Stokes, the vorticity stretching term is stretched by gradient of U, and omega is curl of U. In the Kamasa-Holm equation, the Q is stretched by gradient of U, but Q is not the gradient of U, it's gradient of V, and V is 2 degrees worse than U. So in some sense, the vorticity stretching is stretched by a nicer quantity. And this is the key point why we have global existence in 3D with viscosity. I hope we could show without the viscosity global existence for this equation, because this equation without the viscosity is supposed to look nicer than Navier-Stokes equation, because the vorticity stretching term is stretched by a nicer quantity. And there is hope. I mean, so far we didn't give up on that, but so far there's no really much results in that direction. And as Jerry mentioned earlier this morning, if you want to look at the equation when you don't put viscosity on the V but on the U, this would be Laplacian of omega, if you like. Still, in that case, you cannot prove global existence. So, because the damping is weak, it's not really strong enough to get global existence. Pardon? Small data. Give me a PDE, there is a small data. Almost, of course, not the backward heat. But I agree with you, yeah. I mean, I'm talking about the big results, so, but you're right. Small data, global existence, there is exists. But that talking also, we can talk about the rotating flows, the Babin, Maida, Embed, Mahalov, Nikolayenko, but that's a different story. Okay, however, what is basically the key point, as has been pointed earlier by Jerry's lecture, for the Kamasa-Holm equation or for the averaged equations, whatever called, when you look for the energy, is basically this quantity which is conserved without the viscosity, and this is the quantity which is remains under control under the viscosity. When you look for the first level of energy, you dot the equation with U, you get this evolution of this quantity plus the new, this quantity equal to zero. So when alpha equals identically zero, this is exactly what happens in the Navier-Stokes. But now I have this extra nice stuff, which is in some sense the entropy in Navier-Stokes, which I couldn't control it. And that's the whole key point. I mean, there's nothing much about the existence, except that basically now, because of this nonlinear the dispersion, you get this basically this extra term. And that's how we show global existence for the Kamasa-Holm equation or for this set of equations. Now that you have basically global existence, one can show there exists something called absorbing ball, namely that the lim sup of the norm of the solution bounded uniformly independent of the initial data, depending on some physical parameter like Grashof number, which is defined by the L2 norm of F divided by nu square lambda into the 3/2. And because of that, and because this is a parabolic PDE, one can show that this system of equation has an attractor. And because it has an attractor, one attempts to find the dimension of this attractor. And let me just take you through the jungle of that very fast. So if you give me an evolution equation, and suppose you give me a solution V for this evolution equation, you look for basically linearization. This is like small segment around it. You look for parallelepipe and let them evolve. Each of these segments evolving according to this linearized equation. And when you look for the volume elements, n volume elements, which are denoted by the external product of these, you look for how does these volume elements are evolving. And when you look for this evolution of this volume elements, these volume elements are in some sense coming through determinant, the way we have, like, if you have three vectors, if you have a parallelopipedal, you want to find it, you take basically the coordinates of the vector, you find the determinant. So it's the same thing here. When you take derivative of the determinant, this is supposed to remind us of Wronskian. And Wronskian is supposed to remind us of Abel's formula, or somebody's formula. And therefore, basically, which is involving the trace of the matrix. And this basically, the formula says that Vn, the volume elements, are evolving according to the trace of the linearized operator. And that is the result of Constantine and Foyash from 1983 or something like that, or 82 plus. Basically shows that if you can show that these volume elements are decaying as t goes to infinity for some n large enough, then this n will form an upper bound of the dimension of the fractal and Hausdorff dimension of the attractor. This is, in a nutshell, again, the theory of attractors. Okay, there's a lot of things beyond that, especially in this theorem, how to prove the dimension of the attractor by that. But if you can estimate this, showing that this number, for example, in average, is negative and decaying, then everything is being fine. And this is basically what we use. Now, the whole idea is trying to unfold this trace operator, which is the linearization of the equation underlined, no matter which equation, if it's dissipative. We use some classical inequalities to tighten the screws and to get as best possible estimates, something like the Leap-Thiering inequality, which has also been used by Constantine Foyash and later joined by Timam when they estimated the dimension of the attractor. And another lemma, which is developed particularly, especially for this set of equations, which is basically tells you that if you have a sequence of functions which are orthonormal with respect to this inner product, and if you take this psi j to be this vector, then if you look to the L infinity norm of this vector, it's bounded by these quantities. Now, one can prove this inequality simply by calculus inequalities without a problem. However, this constant here will be depending on n. And the whole idea is how to get an estimate independent of n, because you would like, as I said, to get to squeeze as much juice from the estimates as possible. So we use these two lemmas, and the end of the result, this is basically was in the fall, we basically got the following, that the number of degrees of freedom for the Kamasa-Holm equation or for this alpha equation or model equation is behaving like the dimension of the attractor is L over L epsilon to the power 3. Forget this term for a second. Now, what's L epsilon? This is basically the quantity which dissipates the energy in these equations, as I earlier showed you, the balance of energy. So by analogy with Kolmogorov, you look for the mean rate of dissipation of energy. You average over time, and you take the average when t goes to infinity, and you take the supremum over everything on the attractor, because this equation is an attractor. This is basically equivalent of a mean rate of dissipation of energy for this equation. By analogy with Kolmogorov, you define L epsilon to be the minimum length square, nu cubed divided by S cubed. And therefore, we find that the degrees of freedom of the dimension of the attractor is comparable with this number. And that's basically where the excitement happened. Alpha was anyway ad hoc to the equation. We put it just to make it look nice or to look dimensionally correct. But we tracked it, and therefore, it will play maybe a role soon. But that's where the excitement started, saying, wait a minute, this equation tells us about turbulence more than Navier-Stokes. Why? Because we don't know about attractors for Navier-Stokes. We don't have dimensions for attractors in Navier-Stokes. And we don't know much about it. On the other hand, all these heuristic arguments by physicists, Landau, Lifshitz, and Kolmogorov about degrees of freedom, which tells you the number of degrees of freedom is the large length scale divided by small length scale, the dissipation length scale, cube, fits perfectly here, rigorously, for this equation. And then basically the idea was, wait a minute, turbulence theory is not individual trajectories. It is an average theory. It's a theory which tells you about average quantities. I mean, what's happening to average this, average that. Even when we talk about the spectrum, it's not of individual trajectories. If you take individual trajectory and put its energy spectrum, you wouldn't get this nice k to the minus 5/3 profile. You will get all kind of garbage. When you do some sort of averaging, you get something nice. So therefore, it was the idea that maybe these equations are connected with average quantity-related turbulence. Immediately it crosses your mind that they are related to Reynolds equation, because that's the only average quantities that basically we have in mind we don't know how to solve. So then basically together with the collaborators that I mentioned earlier, we thought about, well, maybe we should take these equations as a closer for Reynolds equation. And then you start saying, well, this is the idea, let's check it. Where do you check it? You look for the easiest possible geometry, easiest possible understood flow. And that's basically where we went into the channel flow. Yes. The second factor, well, okay, alpha at the moment is an ad hoc parameter given to the equation. Now later when we're going to start talking about how to derive the equations, not as a mathematical equations, but as a physical equations, where there's fluctuations and the fluctuations are spatial fluctuations as been introduced earlier this morning, are of order alpha, then alpha is a physical parameter related to the equation. And you, if you take alpha to be comparable with L, like L divided by 7,000, but fixed number, then for us, this is a constant. But if alpha is not comparable with L, L alpha is like a small scale, depends on Reynolds number, then this number could cause us trouble. But at the moment, I just basically put it on this side. Unless there are some more comments from the audience, I mean, because this is, you said it is informal, correct, Peter? Okay, yeah. I will come to that, yeah, maybe later, but... When alpha is smaller, you're getting closer to the Navier-Stokes, don't forget. Alpha is actually, in this case, I would like to think about it as the amount of dispersion you insert to the equation. The more dispersion, the better the equation is behaving, you know? So the less dispersion, the worse it is. So that's basically what's happening.
Epsilon here is not necessarily epsilon to
Navier-Stokes. No, actually it is not. Actually, there's alpha in it. You see? There is alpha in it here. There is alpha in it. So when alpha goes to zero, this part becomes the epsilon of Navier-Stokes. There was another question? Yes and no. Wait a minute. Can you give me a chance? You can have lower bound following the thin long domains a la Babin and Vishik, if you want, by or Sommerfeld, for this equation. I mean, we didn't do it, but you know it's doable. I mean, it's the Babin Vishik lower bound by or Sommerfeld. You can do it by taking long domains and define things. So, for steady state. I believe so, but that's basically the answer. Yes, I mean the bar. Okay, here's my point. In 2D Navier-Stokes, I mean, okay, here is a proposal for NSF. In 2D Navier-Stokes, there was an upper bound a la Constantine, Foyash, and Timam for the dimension of the attractor in 2D Navier-Stokes. The question was, this upper bound achieved by some kind of flow in the world? And the answer was yes, because Babin and Vishik managed to show you that there is a steady state for the 2D Navier-Stokes equation in long domains, okay, such that the number of unstable directions is comparable with the upper bound. And because the number of unstable directions is lower bound for the dimension of the attractor, this is an achieved estimate. Now, I can really propose this to the NSF to do it for this equation, I will get zero money. But because you want to integrate that and get L over L this. Look, alpha is constant for us. I mean, I cannot average of it, because if you change the alphas, you're changing the equations, you're changing the attractors, you're changing the spaces. Yeah, sure, I mean. Sure. Lower bound for what? That's the question. For which equation? With fixed alpha? Then yes. The answer is yes. For fixed alpha, yes. It will be the same lower bound. If you want to change the alpha, you will get something different.
If you increase alpha, you're going to
Well, it depends. Look, I mean, look. Oh, okay. Well, you can change something and fix the other. So the question: what do you want to change? If you want to change, if you want to fix the Reynolds number and change the alpha, that's a different story. Yeah. Because if you like to change alpha slower and smaller, then you're getting closer to Navier Stokes. So in that case, I agree with you. I don't know what would be the answer. Maybe after all, there is a merit for this proposal. Okay, now I will take names of everybody here. One of them will be the referee. All right. Okay, now that basically we finished with this thing and we got excited about these equations like being somehow represent turbulence, we said, well, let's use them as closure for the turbulent flow in the channel. So here's basically the channel is going from minus D to D. Now, we're looking for the Posse flow. This is some experimental data for the average flow. And this is basically the Posse flow itself. And you can see that the average flow and the Posse flow, when you take a large Reynolds number, they are not related because it lost stability. For small Reynolds number, it's stable. And therefore, the long-term behavior, everything will settle into the Posse flow. And everything will be nice and dandy. However, when you take large Reynolds number, it loses stability. And therefore, the average flow is not really the Posse. It is more flattened in the middle. Just a reminder. Now, this is the Reynolds averaged equation. I averaged the Navier-Stokes. There are some facts about the Reynolds average equation from experimental data, namely that the average is basically in the x direction and in the y and z direction is zero. It's function of z alone. It's symmetric around the middle. And if you look to u, basically the fluctuation, this is the fluctuation plus the average, okay, you know something about the fluctuations and what's known about these are physical experimental facts. That the Reynolds stresses, basically, all of them are function of z alone. Reynolds equation, therefore, will boil down to this set of equations in the channel, giving the symmetry and everything that we know. This is basically the set of equations for Reynolds equation in the channel. And we have the closure problem. Namely, I'm interested in u bar, but then I have to solve what these fluctuations and this and this and this, and we don't know how to find them. So that's basically where the closure problem is. This is not a closed system. However, we wanted to use the Kamasa-Holm equation or the average equation. They are not averaged yet. But the average equation as basically an ansatz for closure. So we look for special steady state solution. I didn't put the bar. The bar is for Reynolds equation like that. And plug it into the equation. Therefore, we get this system of equations. And now the Reynolds equation looks like this, and these equations look like that, and therefore you can identify term, by closure, just by observation. This term identified with that, this is with this, this is with zero, and so on and so forth. There's all kind of consistencies to check, and all these consistencies basically after the identification work, all the consistencies work, but we have problems somehow. And the problem is in the last equation. Who is the pressure? Is modulo a constant and all these things? And I will come back to this problem later. But we have problem in the identification. I mean, so it's not really everything nice and dandy. Nonetheless, the Kamasa-Holm equation has an explicit solution. Would you solve it? And this is the explicit formula of the solution. Notice that alpha is an outside parameter. D is the width of the channel given. But then because you get A and B, another two constants which are free. And now here basically the problem, where they are coming free, because I don't have any boundary conditions, because this is fourth order equation in V, on U. And all what I know is U equals to zero at the boundary. Therefore, I don't know what's the boundary conditions in that system. And therefore, gives me this extra A and B. And that's basically now where we start playing the game of how do we fix this AB? Do they depend on our Reynolds number? How do they depend on Reynolds number? Does the alpha depend on Reynolds number? And so on and so forth. But meanwhile, let me just basically give you some physical parameters because I'm gonna use them later. I'm gonna denote tau zero to be the boundary stress, and this is basically defined by this. And I'm going to look at the average velocity. I'm going to denote U bar to be the average velocity across the channel because I'm going to define different Reynolds number. One depends on the boundary stresses, and the other one depends on the average. So this is the Reynolds number depends on the flux, the first one, and this is depends on the boundary. There's the different length scale in the equation, the width of the channel, alpha, which is an ad hoc so far, and the wall units, basically determined by the stresses on the boundary. So there's some mathematical parameters which is are not really very of importance. There's an assumption that if you look at xi, which is v over alpha, we assume at least at the very beginning that when Reynolds number becoming larger and larger, alpha is getting smaller and smaller, and therefore as r becoming very large, alpha is very small. And therefore we get these mathematical parameters. Look that the b is really involved, r0 is involved. There is all kind of relations between these things. How can you figure it all out based on experimental data and so on and so forth? The idea is to go into the normalized velocity profile at the wall. Okay, so this is basically eta is the units of the wall, from the distance from the wall, and this is the velocity profile, average velocity profile from the wall, and phi eta is the graph that basically we would like to reproduce. Now notice that we have u explicitly, but it has some free parameters that need to be adjusted. And this is basically the quantity that we are going to go after. As I said, there's so many free parameters. One can show using the explicit solution we found for Reynolds for Kamasa-Hom equation that phi eta asymptotically, because I assume that alpha is very small or Reynolds number is very large, we get that phi eta behaves like this relationship. Theta and delta still are free. This is the drag law for the friction at the wall. This is D. Now basically for the drag law at the boundary, you have different laws. There's the Blasius law and there is the von Karman law. Which one you use as a closure to connect the R0 and R, namely the Reynolds number based on the flux and the Reynolds number depends on the boundary. So you have two choices. At any rate, we took the Blasius, and then one can get basically that phi related to the, no, it's not yet. You can basically show that this phi is related is a equation of this type, modulo relationship between R and R0, modulo a constant that needs to be determined. So we're nailing the problem slowly down. And now you have three parameters, C, R, and R0 free. Or if you want CR and the drag law, if you use Blasius drag law, it gives you a relationship where lambda is a constant which is given physically. You remain only with two constants. One is the Reynolds number and one something you need to find or adjust. Reynolds number is giving input for the flow and you end up with only one parameter. So you have to do some tuning, you do some experiments, and we had wonderful two people helped us, Eric who's sitting here in the audience and actually not helped us, they did the work. I mean, they did really the work and as far as the computation stuff is concerned. Okay, so this is the experimental data that I told you from Wellmarth that I told you about earlier. This is the experimental data. This is the corresponding Reynolds number based on the boundary stresses. And these basically lines which are solid, which are really, I put them, are exactly the solutions from the Kamasa-Hom equation. And these basically the corresponding Poisson flows here. But these ones which are here, experimental data, we can match that exactly by the exact solution that we found. So the thing about this model is you find the solution all across the channel. It's not only near the boundary here or near the boundary there. Either you make it or break it. Either you are doomed or you can. So it's not only near the boundary a little bit and inside the little bit. You have one formula for everything. And as you see that basically it's matched very nice, and therefore we concluded, well, this suits better to turbulence. And in that time, basically, where Daryl and Jerry and Ratio basically worked on deriving the equations as an averaged equation to relate them to these things. And that's when the name averaged alpha came into the equation, because now these equations, which were mathematical, they have some physical context, and the question, how can we derive them from by physical means. Of course, the equations have constitutive law and so on and so forth, but there was no physical principles to derive them from. And then it has been derived by as I said, by Daryl, Jerry, and Tudor. Yes, we have questions here.
R what?
No. As you remember, I mean, here's what's the formula in general. We have only one, first the Reynolds number, we nailed the problem into, by because we used Blasio's law, we nailed it to two free parameters, Reynolds number, which is given to you by the flow, and one tuning parameter. Is given by experimental data, which is constant, universal constant, at least the way people believe. So we took that as is. Okay? So it's the one tuning parameter. Very sensitive, not sensitive. It is sensitive a little bit, but if you wait until the end, you will see that it's sensitive almost zero. But at the very beginning, for a small Reynolds number, it's sensitive. For a small Reynolds number. But later you will see that it is sensitivity to Reynolds number, when you talk about high Reynolds number, really high Reynolds numbers in millions, it's almost not sensitive. You will see that in a minute. Mildly depends on Reynolds number. At the moment, we allowed it to depend on Reynolds number mildly. We cannot derive. We worked for almost 6 months to derive a formula for it. How does it depend? But we couldn't. And then with experiment, notice there is something here. For the channel flows, you cannot do very high Reynolds number experiments. You can do direct numerical simulations, but even then, you cannot really rely on them. But for pipe flows, you can go for high Reynolds number, and therefore experiments from high. If you would like to develop theory for a very, very high Reynolds number, then you have to use experiments somehow from pipes. And that's what we're going to go and compare with the pipes. And then we will see that the sensitivity of the parameters on this Reynolds number is very, very, very mild, almost not noticeable. In some sense, we wasted so much time in trying to match or trying to find it for these good high Reynolds number, but they are not very high enough. So in some sense, they were too ambitious in some sense. Other questions? Okay. The velocity is zero at the boundary. No, even here.
It is.
Here it is, yeah. But now the problem is that the equation we have is fourth order, not two or second order. You need another two parameters. So we can do linear algebra. Don't worry about that. Yeah. Okay, so now I'm going to just basically show some computations with the. Well, okay, so here's basically just to give you, having the Blasius law, this is basically comparing with data from we and Walmart. This is the phi of eta, and this is the log of eta. And this is basically the profile that they get. This is the experimental data, as you know, from the boxes and triangles. And this is the graph that we have all the way up to here. Just basically to show you. Now, here's another one for other Reynolds number. You can see that there is consistency or a relationship. But we are trying to be honest, trying as much as we could. So now the question would be, what about the Reynolds stresses that we claimed we solved? Okay, there is experimental data for that. Okay, the solid graphs are basically our predictions, and the data is basically given here. You see that far away from, not too close, within a unit away from the, within log of unit from away from the boundary, with these are the units of the boundary, the walls, the distance from the walls. The log of that, okay. So up to here, basically from here on, it's nice, but all the way down, we couldn't match. And we were trying very hard to match it. So let me give you other one. So as you can see that there is some matching with other Reynolds stresses. This is basically the WU Reynolds stresses. There is some matching as much as we could. But, you know, not really perfectly. I mean, sometimes we miss, like here, we miss a little bit, you know. Maybe engineers would say, well, what do you want? This is perfect. I mean, but we maybe were demanding too much. I don't know. However, we're not really just demanding too much. There is some problems with the issue. On the other hand, we also suspicious about the experimental data near the boundary, how close you can get to the boundary reliably. And we don't know that, neither. So there was a problem with this data, and I'm just basically telling you the story in full, so you know the successes and the failures as well. We tried to change alpha because at the moment alpha is a number which is fixed, but if now we basically did all these calculations, and Daryl and Jerry and Tudor came with these derivations that this alpha has a physical meaning, it's the size of the fluctuations, we said, aha, now wait a minute, maybe alpha inside and alpha near the boundary should be different. So where we have been taking here alpha to be constant. So now we basically said, aha, maybe alpha near the boundary should be a function of the distance from the boundary, now that it has physical meaning for the equations. And we took some, just for the sake of, I mean, after experimenting so much, we took some distance, the delta zero from the boundary, and we cut the alpha near the boundary, zero. Well, it's symmetric. Well, you didn't object when this was written in Japanese. Nobody could read it. Oh yeah, okay. Alright, so we took alpha to be constant inside as we had been discussed, and we took it zero in here, just in this, and then we looked at the stresses, what's happening there. Of course when you do that, like basically cutting and pasting, look to the match. It just basically boom, dropped perfectly as you wanted it. Now we have another parameter, the distance from the boundary, how much you should cut from the boundary. So this is basically just to show you that we really tried really hard to get things. But now I'm going to move into the Zagarola experiment of the superpipe in Princeton. Pardon? Well, actually, in that sense, maybe alpha has been lost in all these parameters. Do you remember how much it's related to the d over xi? D over xi, just a second, I will show you. D over xi, so it's xi. Here it is, almost half. Oh, we will see it here. Just a second. Because it depends on which Reynolds. I don't understand. I don't understand the question, sorry.
Small alpha would imply that you are solving this equation from the mesh with that size alpha.
Yeah. So you're solving it in a very small alpha. And? On that mesh. And? Well, this is the, at this moment, if you want to, okay, again, I'm trying just to put the two scenarios together because we listened to different lectures today. At this moment, these were mathematical equations. And then when derived by later as an averaged equation, it was assumed isotropy. This means all directions are the same. All people are equal. Okay? And the only thing we wanted is basically when you get closer to the boundary, what do? You have to be maybe biased like an ellipsoid. So there is problems. I mean, I'm not saying this is everything is perfect. So in that sense, I'm just showing you data which is based on not. We don't know how much. I mean, from the experimental data, we don't know. That's a valid point to be checked. You know, I agree with you. But we got it as God-given experimental data. We trusted the guys in Michigan, and we took it. You know. So, but now I'm going to go to the superpipe experiments, and this is basically the Zagarola experiment for different Reynolds number. This is the R, which is like just for sake of argument, 31,000. This is in the superpipe. This is basically the Kamasa-Holm equation, how does it do, and this is his data. But now, instead of using, when we solve the equation in the pipe, you have different symmetries, we don't get cosches and cinches, we get special functions like Bessel functions, and this is basically special Bessel functions, I0 function, and we have explicit formula as well, as we said. And of course, for this Reynolds number, they are depending on the Reynolds number. What we did is the following experiments. What we took certain Reynolds number, say 15,700, and we fixed the parameters from this data to match as much as possible the Zagarola data. And then, once we fix this constant, or these constants, we basically start jacking up the Reynolds number without changing them, constant. And we start seeing basically the dashed line, as you see it here from the key, the Zagarola delta is the solid, our curve is the dashed one, and then the log law of von Karman, and then the Chonin-Barenblatt. I will talk about the Chonin-Barenblatt theory later. But you can see that ours is matching is as much as possible, you can see here. We go for higher Reynolds number with the same fixed parameter. Again, it's matching. We go for higher Reynolds number with this. Pardon? Oh, you lost your glasses. Here they are. Now, it's 17,629,500. Where is the pipe, super pipe, in Princeton? Okay. This is the flux Reynolds number, I said. This is not the R0. R0 is the stresses. Okay. And this is again, the Zagarola data is the one with the head, like with the chevron. This is ours matching, and you can see the bottom line Chorin start deviating from it. So you can see that basically the sensitivity of the parameters on Reynolds number for higher Reynolds number is not really there. Maybe there is, but I don't know how does it really depend. Maybe 1 over R or 1 over log R or something like that. Now, one last comment just to mention here, that these equations or this theory works nicely here, while the basically the Barenblatt-Chorin theory, which is basically reduced theory for part of the channel, deviates from the theory. Of course, Barenblatt and Chorin argued that the reason there's difference between the experimental, between the Zagarola data and Chorin and the Barenblatt theory, this discrepancy, they explain it because the pipe is not smooth enough, and therefore the theory is for smooth pipes, and maybe the experiments are not clean enough. On the other hand, we get match. I don't know what this means. Either we and Zagarola are in the same boat, which is we're not accurate, or I don't know what. Now, one more thing I wanted to mention, the chevron. I would like to mention something about this chevron. This is really an interesting chevron from dynamical system point of view. We are sort of proud of it. Most of the theories that basically talk about the law of the wall and so on and so forth cannot predict this chevron. They cannot really follow the chevron all the way down. The chevron, they give you only part of the wall, but not all the way to the, because the chevron is closer and closer to the center. And how can we get it? Of course, we are all the way at, so we are all the way going to the thing. So, you can do what? Yeah. By a given function with two parameters? Any function in the world? Alpha is fixed now, the parameters are fixed. The wall, we are deviating very, here we are deviating because there is not even experimental data down there. Near the wall, they don't have experimental data, they cannot measure all the way near the wall. Yeah.
So,
but cutting and pasting. Cutting and pasting. Here, one function does it all.
No, you're not cutting and pasting with Reynolds average.
You're saying that you have two laws, one near the boundary and one in the middle.
But you have to do that too near the boundary, right? Because you don't hit the boundary either.
No, but there's no data near the boundary anyway. Near the boundary, we're not claiming anything near the boundary. I mean, as I told you, this thing, we're not claiming anything near the boundary being precise, whatever. And I told you, we have problem near the boundary, and we're not claiming that. Or what I'm trying to talk about the chevron. None of the theories predicted the chevron. Is there, I mean, Leslie, do you know of anybody who could predict the chevron? The going around. It's done the fitting for to fit here. But nobody is fitting near the wall. Anyways, okay, all right, okay. We can I would have suggested to discuss it over dinner, but she's not coming. No, she's not coming. So I have to close it. Okay, I have to close it here. But I would like to give you why we can get this chevron, at least understanding it. If you remember, the equation has two parts. The solution of the Kamasohm equation has two parts, and this is very important to show you now. Remember the A and the B at the very beginning. Charlie, you were my roommate. You don't remember anything. Okay. You can see, this is basically A, and this is B. Now, notice, if you take B to be zero, means like very, very small, and you look for this part, you would never, ever predict the chevron. Would never, ever. It will just shoot up. If you take B equals zero and A, you get basically something which is not at all. Sorry, if you take B zero, you get this part. You don't predict the chevron. If you take A zero, you get basically the Posé flow, perfectly Posé flow. Now this mix, this specific mix, namely that you need some part of this B in order to get the chevron. With the way we interpret it is, given the fact that even the Navier-Stokes, if it has some sort of attractor, even though the Posé flow is unstable. And you don't see it in nature, but you visit it once in a while. And the invariant measure on the attractor, if there is such a thing, has to give it some weight. And that weight is basically related to this B, which gives you the chevron, at least through this theory. So that's basically a philosophical point of view to try to sell you of why this is really works and we can predict it. Thank you for your patience. And there's more to be said.